based on like deals I've done in the past, like to get acquired, I always took the safer route. I didn't bet on myself. Mm-hmm. I bet on, let me take the more stable option. Okay, and I Katie. Think in this case, I was like, I've seen, I think it's like learning like, okay, I think I know what I'm capable of. I think I know what I, how much work I'm going to bring to the table and what I'm going to, I think I can make that happen for myself. So let me bet on me this time.
Yeah.
And only do one.
I get that.
And then say, I think this is going to blow it out of the water. And I want the opportunity in the future to be able to go back and have the leverage of like, I didn't already sell the second one.
You know, they say women shouldn't be bossy.
We're out here reclaiming that word. What's so wrong with being the boss? I'm Tara Reid, the CEO of a multi-million dollar ed tech business.
And I'm Katie Gatti-Tossan, better known as Money with Katie on the internet.
At our core, we're driven by a shared ambition to build our own mini empires.
Welcome to Bossy.
Okay, I'm really excited about this conversation.
Let me guess why.
We're talking about deals, doing deals.
You love a deal.
I love a good deal.
Okay, I need to borrow some of your enthusiasm about this.
Yeah, this is why
gives me major imposter syndrome.
Doing deals? This is why I love playing Monopoly.
Bro.
All the time.
The Monopoly obsession, I don't get it.
I'm obsessed. I play, like, you know, like you would look at the screen time on your iPhone and it tells you how much time you spend on different devices. Like,
yes.
I think I spend a lot of time. I sent you a screenshot of this. Do you remember what it was?
Oh, yeah. It was like 9 hours a week.
9 hours a week. That's about right.
That is,
like, when I'm
that's
done
over
working,
an hour a day. Is that just how you decompress?
Yeah, like when I'm done. Yeah, so when I'm done working, I sit on the couch, I put on silly reality TV, and I start a game of Monopoly. Like, that's my decompress. And the reason I love Monopoly is, like, Monopoly is a game of doing deals. It's a game of strategy. It's a game of concentrated positions. You can't win Monopoly by, like, oh, let me, like, spread myself across.
Dilly-dallying around the board.
You don't dilly-dally, right?
No.
So, like, my strategy,
you double down.
So, like, and often people talk about Monopoly takes a long time. Like, oh, that's a game that takes forever.
Yeah. Well, as evidenced by the 9 hours a week.
Well, I'm getting multiple games in.
Fair
criticism.
Because
the game goes fast if you have you've got some risk tolerance. If everybody has low risk tolerance, the game takes forever because no one wants to make a big move.
Mm.
So, like, my strategy with Monopoly is, like, we go a couple rounds and I sort of just, like, lay cool, see how things land. And then I pick a color property I'm going to go after and I just, like, go in. Whatever deal I got to do, even if it's a seemingly unreasonable deal, I'll pay you 3x for that property because I want to get to position fast. I won't pay, like, way too much for the property, but, like, I'll pay you more.
3x, though. 3x is fine.
Usually 2.5.
I was going to say 3 is a little aggressive.
3 is aggressive, but, like, if people aren't budging, I'm going to get in there, provided that I still got enough cash reserves. And this is funny because it, like, mirrors my business strategy, I think.
I was just going to say, man, maybe this is why I'm not comfortable with this, because my decompression is just, like, scrolling Reddit. So I think I need to be more strategic about my downtime.
I mean, whatever's fun, but, like, for me, it's fun. And the whole time I'm reading the other players and their relationship with risk. So I can tell, like, oh, you're not willing to go to zero.
Read me. What's my relationship with risk? Be direct.
Great. Okay, so you've got some riskiness because you're an entrepreneur and, like, you've got to have some to even do this at all. So,
mm-hmm.
like, it's not really low. I think if I had to put it on, like, a scale of 10, like, 1 to 10. I love to put stuff on scales of 10. If I put it scale 1 to 10, I would maybe put it at, and 7's not allowed.
No 7's.
Because 7's the, like, cop
I have
out.
A number in my head of what I think I am.
I'm going to give you, like, a 5 or a 6.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, which one?
Yeah.
5 or 6.
I was going to say, like, a 6. Because I think I'm a little comfortable with it. But
I
think there are areas of business where I feel super out of my depth.
Yeah.
And I think doing deals, I always feel like Donald Trump when I say, like,
doing
I feel like I have
deal.
To do, like, a Long Island accent, like, doing deals.
Oh, interesting, because you feel like that means that doing deals maybe feels like a sleazy thing to you. Does that imply that?
It just feels so apprentice-y. Like, I feel like I need to be in, like, a guild. Like Trump Tower. But so this is what I wanted to ask you about, though. Can you give me some, like, examples? Like, I think when I'm hearing this, what I'm struggling with is picturing what this would look like for me. But I think in order to get there, I need to know, like, when I think of doing deals, I'm thinking like, okay, you're not just running a company. You're not just running a business. You're like building an empire. You're like, you know what I mean? It's like sprawling. That's kind of the sense I get.
Yes. When I think about that, I often think about like Walt Disney. Have you seen that Walt Disney drawing?
Yeah.
He did really early on where it has like all of the different like parts of the organization. There's like TV and production. There's merchandise. There's like all these different things, licensing to all kinds of things. And there's a line between each of the different parts of the org chart. And it talks about like what the relationship is between each of the segments. Like, I love businesses that are creating these, like, to your point, empires and structures.
These, like, whole ecosystems that kind of, like, boost one another. Yeah. There's a little bit of a flywheel. I'm hitting you with a lot of jargon right now.
We're in the flywheel. MBA.
Synergy.
Synergy is business words. Run it up the chain. Yeah, exactly. So
run it up the chain.
There's a really funny, it's like a BuzzFeed video, and they make a rap song out all the corporate lingo. Circle back. Exactly.
Touch
but they're
base.
Like beatboxing, touch base. Have you seen that?
It's no, but I just hear these words all day long, so I feel like I could write this rap myself now.
Yeah. We're going to table that. Like all of those things.
Oh, yeah. For a second, I was like, oh, okay, we can table it.
You're like, yeah, I know those words. Yeah. They're like all things like you don't say in real life, but you say it at work, and it like doesn't even make any sense. Yeah.
Maybe that should be our I'll new thing to is to bring, yeah, send it to me. We should bring back the corporate jargon in personal relationships.
No, we should not.
Or do the opposite, where we just start speaking very directly to one another.
People should just say the real thing.
Say
like what it actually means. No one knows what that acronym is, bruh.
Well, help me with the, help me with the empire thing.
Yes.
What's an example?
Okay, well, I think my favorite empire is talking about Disney. That's not my favorite.
Yeah.
My favorite is LVMH, Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy.
Well, I like Louis Vuitton.
Which is already
tell me more.
Like giving you empire conglomerate vibes just in the name.
Yeah, it's a little, it's almost a little confusing to me. Where I'm like, wait a second, Hennessy, what? Like,
yeah, because the brand is not the individual brand. So LVMH is like this holding company that owns like Sephora, Dior, Louis Vuitton, Givenchy, Fendi, like a bunch of Tiffany and Company, like a bunch of brands they own, a bunch of alcohol brands too. Like everything that's like luxury, they got it. And so this guy, Bernard Arnault, started it. And he kind of like started his journey. He was working in his family construction business. The family like kind of already had, there was some money to start with.
Okay.
So, like, this is not, like, rags to riches kind of story. However, the amount of, like, doubling of growth, not doubling, way more than doubling of growth, like, you still have to give him credit for. So
I feel you. Okay.
Yeah. So there was a market crash. He was living in, like, he's from France.
Can you give me, like, a time period? Like, what am I picturing?
I think this is, like, 80s.
Okay.
Mid-80s.
That would make sense. Market crash.
Market crash.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of distressed companies, and he buys this, like, bankrupt textile company.
Huh.
And the French government had this program where you could buy a distressed business for like $1, like a dollar.
Oh.
Yes.
Because they're just trying to like stimulate economic
activity. They're trying to stimulate the economy, but you got to take on the debt of the business.
Oh, yeah. Big catch.
Big catch. You got to take on the debt. But like, you might have, like, there's a lot of scenarios where, like, the assets are worth more than the debt.
Right.
People want to, you have to find a buyer who's willing to sell off the companies, get them back working, replenish anything. There's a factory
that's
broken out. Like, there's a lot of work. So you got to find the right buyer. But there's a lot of deals and scenarios in general where, like, the assets are just worth more than the debt.
Oh, yeah. Like, if you were to liquidate everything, you'd be like, okay,
well,
you just
got to do the work.
Yeah.
Right. So this is exactly, I don't know exactly how much debt he took on, but, like, he starts by getting a good-ass deal.
All
right. Right.
Good-ass deal.
Good-ass deal.
He's putting that house on Boardwalk.
Yeah.
So this is mine now.
Monopoly. Right. So of the textile company, there are a couple different companies inside that are owned by this, and Christian Dior is one.
Oh.
Christian Dior is one, and like a department store too. So he sells off all of the other assets. He keeps those two, Christian Dior and the department
store. I wonder why those were the two he kept. Like, I wonder when
what he was thinking.
Yeah. Like, I think that'd be where I would get stuck. It's like, all right, what's valuable? I mean, I wonder if that's just gut instinct.
Would you make your decision based on like what goes together
vibes.
Or what?
Straight vibes.
Not a P&L. I feel like you would make show me the numbers.
No. It would be I want to see a spreadsheet.
Yeah. I wonder if like
show me that Excel 87. Like I need to see the
I wonder if he sold off like the best assets or kept
right?
The best
like that's
assets.
What I'm saying is I feel like there's probably I'm sure there was a strategy there. It obviously worked, but I wonder what the underlying thought process was. Like, I need to get some cash quickly, so I'm going to keep the shittiest stuff. Or, like, what these things show the most promise. Probably would have kept the things that show the most promise. Assuming that I can actually then create, even if I'm cash flow negative for longer, these things have the most growth potential.
But that's high risk tolerance.
So I'm like an eight, really.
You might have graduated to an eight.
Okay, so he keeps the two.
He keeps the two. Like, 4 years later, he takes $15 million. I know that sounds like a lot, but it's like the company's now worth like $400 billion. So, like,
with a B?
Yeah. So
$400 billion.
This is why I was like, you still have to give him credit for like the increase.
Oh my God,
the increase. So, and I always hate, by the way, when people say like what the company's worth, because like, how did you value it? What, like, I just feel like it doesn't.
Yeah, and like tech multiples are like 300 times.
Yeah, and also like even when people talk about celebrities and like this person's worth this and has this net worth.
It's like, I want to see what's in the Chase checking account.
I'm skeptical.
I want to see what you actually have liquid
access. No, because like cash is not like net worth, but yes, right. Like,
but as a personal finance person, I'm like, is that person, are they worth, like the layperson here is, oh, you're worth $100 billion. It's like, that's not accessible. Money.
So just to translate that. So let me translate that, because I want to hear revenue usually, that if it's a business revenue, which is, I think, the equivalent for a person of like bank account.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So from a revenue perspective, like that gives me better idea than what a company's worth.
Yeah.
So now if we look fast forward, LVMH, I was saying it's currently worth maybe like $400 billion, but they still do $53 billion a year. Right, that gives you a sense. Like, it's not like a small company, right? $53 billion. So he takes $15 million. Turns it into $53 billion per year, right? Okay. So what he does is he takes some of this money from the companies that are running, and he buys a stake in Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy. They had been like trying to do some deals together, those companies, Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, they already existed. And he kind of does this like aggressive deal to buy his way in. And it kind of like, it's borderline hostile takeover. Which like, I'm into.
I'm into it. You're into the hostel, the PE style.
It's fascinating to hear about, right? Oh. So there's actually a really good episode. It's a podcast called Acquired. Mm. They like go into depth of this. Essentially, like if you fast forward, he's bought like 70 companies.
Oh my God.
And there's this whole conglomerate of like all these businesses. And I think that's my favorite empire. What, do you have a favorite empire?
Yeah, but I'm about to reveal my basic bitch taste.
What's the empire?
I feel like it's almost, I don't want to say borderline cancelable, because it's not cancelable. What? But I love the Kardashians, and I feel like
bitch, me too. Kardashians
but
are great.
I feel like I shouldn't. Like, I have mixed feelings about it. Because I think that there are some,
they're great business people.
Yes, I think that's the distinction. It's like, I think that there are some things that the Kardashians, the way that they've impacted culture, I don't know that I'm fully on board with. But I think from a business standpoint, there's like a genius, like, I don't think people give Kris Jenner enough credit. I think this whole, like,
she's out here doing deals.
The momager deals. Joke. Listen, Kris Jenner, she was married to a very prominent LA attorney. Obviously, everyone and their mother knows the story. But she was like a housewife. She didn't have any access to the money. Like, she's talked about how she had no control, no autonomy. She basically got like an allowance, right? She sold the reality show to Ryan Seacrest in like 3 days.
Interesting.
At 51 years old. And basically turned like that same situation that you just said of like, this man probably already had some money, but it takes quite a bit of savvy to go to what, $53 billion a year in like that didn't happen by accident.
From like one franc. To
same situation. This woman was obviously very privileged, but she has a net worth now of like $200 million. Yeah. Like, I think she's a shark, honestly.
Yeah.
And I think that we could all learn a lot from the way that she structures.
Absolutely. However,
but I mean, like, I think there are, like, I would look at someone like that and go like, Is there some strange, like, I don't know. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I'm sure there's some weird ethical things with the family. I don't, maybe some of it is a little bit sketchy, but just from a sheer business perspective, I think the Kardashians, we will be studying them for decades to come.
100%. I don't even know that they get enough credit for the like whole portfolio of brands.
I don't think they do.
Okay. What are the brands that you know that they have?
So I know, let's start at the bottom. So Kylie has like Kylie Cosmetics, yep. which I think was like, I think they're actually buying back the stake that Coty bought in them. Like they sold it.
Coty
is like the makeup brand that paid like $51 million dollars for something. And I think Kylie is actually like, buying
that back.
Give it back. There's like Kylie Skin, Kylie Baby even. Like there's multiple.
Did you see that episode on the Kardashians? I also watch the Kardashians religiously. Like, yeah. I tune in.
I've watched them every year. Like I started watching that show in middle school.
I think they're wonderful. So did you see that episode where Kylie is like doing her first launch on the website and they think that the website, like everything crashed right when they launched, but really like
it just sold out that quickly.
In that second.
That's the thing. It's a cult of personality. Yeah. And I don't think people understand how hard that is to do, because there's not even a think of a comp. You can't. Who is comparable, right? I mean, like, I think there are some. Okay, I'll say this. There are comps that are not as like I would put like a Taylor Swift, a Beyonce. Like there are other people that have that star power, but they had talent. That's the thing. Like who has built this much of a following alone?
Now I'm gonna defend the Kardashians though, because like I think they got talent. They got a lot of talent. They're out here doing deals and create like.
But what is
what they have?
Everyone else that has this much, star power. Was a singer or an actress or a like they were the original influencers that used I think their rise kind of coincided with social media.
Yes.
But I don't think there's anyone else that has the fame, the command of media but the whole their criticism is actually their biggest selling point, which is they're famous for being famous. No one else is famous for being famous.
Which is a talent in and of itself.
That is the
you
talent.
Pioneer a field of being famous for being famous. So yeah, I'm with that. But question.
Yeah.
Did you see Kris Kardashian's masterclass?
Kris Jenner.
Oops, sorry.
Put some respect on that name, Tara.
My bad. Kris Jenner's masterclass.
Yeah, regrettably. I was really disappointed.
Oh, you paid money for it? I watched it on
the plane. I joined
the
masterclass.
They got it on the Delta licensing deal. Licensing deal.
Doing deals.
Yeah, I watched it. It was trash. She said absolutely nothing. She said nothing.
I know. I really wanted her to. I wanted the inside scoop on particularly like, I think that there's a certain point beyond which, now it's not impressive anymore for Kim Kardashian to get an impressive business deal because she's Kim Kardashian. I want to hear, how did you make her into Kim Kardashian in 2010? What was the strategy with Kylie on Instagram 2013? Was that an accident?
How did you handle the Pepsi contract and Pepsi deal? Like, what was the back and forth? How did you handle when it went wrong?
The mechanics of like, how these things are happening behind the scenes. And I guess like personal brand, that's a little squishy. Like, I guess that, but yeah, I was hoping for some harder hitting.
Yeah, she was generally
information.
Like, you gotta love your family and stick tight and you gotta build a brand around things you love. Like, you don't have to watch the masterclass now. Like, that was the whole thing.
That was the masterclass. You just gave it to him.
Done. I want to know, like, how do you find leaders for your portfolio of companies?
Mm-hmm.
How do you find an operator? Of integration that, like, how much creative time are you spending with them, or are you just like, you do what you want and fly? Like, I think, like, for example, like Kim presents to be pretty involved with Skims. She's like, I'm testing new fabrics and materials, but like, how much is that just like, I just looked at it real quick, or like, how, like, I'm curious about that.
You know, what
someone who is trying to figure out, like, how much do I delegate, how much do I stay creatively involved, like, I want to know that.
You know what's really funny too is it took me a second to pick up on this, but I did watch the Hulu reboot, the Kardashians, and
of course it's on right now.
It occurred to me probably like toward the end of the first season, like, wait a second, this entire show is an ad. Every single episode is about their portfolio.
And it's so good. The wedding episode.
It's
the wedding,
all an ad.
But all of reality TV is an ad. Like, for example, when you watch Real Housewives, everybody, first of all, very few are housewives. Everybody's got a business.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's there to promote the business.
But
that's
new, right? That's new. That is not how reality television used to be. But that's what I think is so genius about the Kardashians is they sunsetted Keeping Up, and then they came back with Hulu, and they had all the leverage.
You know, they negotiated the hell out of that
second deal. And they said, this is going to be a way for us to sell Skims, to sell Good American. Yep. They just turned, and that's it. You take it. Yep. It's like the Barbie model too. It's like the IP that sells the thing, but it's in a way.
Wait,
it's
the Barbie
bigger
model?
Than that. How now Mattel is trying to get into intellectual property. They're trying to kind of transcend the like retail goods space, and they're trying to really like branch out. I don't know. Maybe
interesting.
It's
I didn't know
thing.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. But okay, so what's the tangible takeaway? Like when I'm looking at someone like Bernard Arnault and yes. the LVMH model,
yeah.
like if I'm saying, okay, well, I have this business now
yeah.
and I want to dabble in, maybe I don't want to like full on bring something
do deals.
In. I want to do a deal. But I want to do it like, well, what's the like baby step deal?
Please stop saying it like
I
that.
I can't
please.
Help it. I can't help it. There's well, something so cheesy about it that I can't, it, I can't get
to me,
past.
It's more like do a deal. Like we're going to like do
oh,
that.
You're
we're
like
gonna
gritting
do
your
that
teeth.
Thing. Yeah.
Do that deal.
Do that deal.
Okay.
That's more
what's
of like the energy
step,
of it.
Though?
Okay. So I think that for, okay, one of the things I think is interesting about Bernard Arnault's LVMH moves is that he has like a community-based thesis, a customer-based thesis. It's not like all of the businesses are the same,
oh,
right? There's makeup, okay. there's clothes, there's alcohol, though, there's watches. It's luxury. And people who love luxury.
Community-based, like yeah.
People who love luxury.
Like, this is my demo, and I'm going to sell people. Them this whole circle of things.
I'm going to lock in on the bougie market, and like it's more about the community. So I do think like there's two different ways that like us as small business owners and building mini empires, like we can take those learnings mm-hmm. and actually implement it. There's probably like a basic mode and an advanced mode, or maybe intermediate mode, advanced
yeah.
mode. Yeah.
Hard mode. Okay.
Intermediate mode, hard mode. So I think intermediate mode is like just partnerships. Right. So mm-hmm. going to other people who have, if you have a business, going to other entrepreneurs who have similar audiences, maybe they have different products, but similar audiences. Let's say you guys all have dog products, like products for pet owners. Right. That's
so
the
you're not competing, but you're just selling to the same.
You're
group
not
of
competing.
People.
Like you've got the like travel case for when you like take your pet on like a trip and you have pet food.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe on the confirmation page of your like Shopify store, you actually have like maybe you do a cross promotion like, hey, we have this other partner company and you guys work together to give each other like a referral fee or something like that, sort of like an affiliate partnership. Mm-hmm. That is still doing a deal around
okay,
community.
That's
you
fair.
Guys get share of revenue. You help each other sort of build and grow businesses. That takes like a conversation.
Yeah, that's that seems pretty low stakes.
Conversation and like some way to track like, oh, this came from you.
Yes.
You referred that person to me.
Okay, that's an interesting distinction,
yeah.
I think.
That's actually how I started Apps Without Code. Like we did our first workshop because I'd had a lot of people like emailing me, asking me because I'd been blogging about building Apps Without Code. That was like the most popular blog.
Oh.
Yeah. My first company was called Collecto. I had a blog called Building Collecto. And it was talking to myself, but like the most popular blog post was about how I built the app without code.
Okay.
So then what I realized was people were interested in this, and I did a workshop about this, and I just asked friends who had similar audiences of people starting entrepreneurship, entering tech, to like, hey, if you send people to my workshop, I'll give you, and people sign up for the program, I'll give you a percentage of their like sign up amount.
I didn't realize though that was kind of the impetus.
Yeah.
That you were doing something else, right? And you
yeah,
made,
I had
you
another
were writing
company.
A blog post that was about how you built that without code, and then everyone was like, oh wait, yeah. but wait, tell us more about that. And you're like, oh, that's what people want to know.
That's exactly right. So I had an art startup called Collecto. I had done this program where I was flying to New York, and there was like a side project accelerator. So my side project of the art startup, I built this algorithm that matches people to artwork based on their taste.
Okay.
So it like pulls internet art from the internet and then matches you to like painting, photography, etc. And so I had started that as a side project. We had made like $35,000 of revenue by the time it had gone to like full time.
Okay.
And then I had been building that and working on that, and people were asking me, how did you make that app?
Oh my gosh.
And there were enough people that I was like, oh wait, like I can't ignore all these emails. I need to like just help some people. And so I helped 5 people launch their app just from people who had like emailed me.
Okay.
And then I kind of put together a more formal structure around it, asked friends to kind of do a partnership with me to promote it, the workshop
okay.
I was doing. And then there were like 70 people.
Oh my God. And okay. Like, oh, that's gosh, so interesting that that was the, that
but
was
the growth
start.
Came from doing the partnership deal. And okay. It did take some effort to like call people, explain to them what I was doing. Like we had to sort of talk about different ways mm-hmm. to do the partnership, but like that was what happened.
Okay. Well, I didn't really realize that that was like, I don't know. In my mind, that was not in the same vein as this kind of, you know, bringing other businesses into the fold or buying other businesses.
You're saying partner. It didn't feel like partnerships were deal.
No, not at all.
Enough.
So I guess I think kind
you
of
have
been
this
doing
voice.
That. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you have the voice on it that like maybe like deals partnerships are
Long
deal.
Island accent.
Yeah, because the long like partnerships are deals.
Yeah.
In fact, I think like most full mergers and acquisitions start with a little bit of a partnership first. You want to test it out to see if you even like working together.
True. Okay. Okay. Well then, so, all right. So let's say.
I generally think of like the like just working in a business and figuring out like, what are we going to do next? How is this going to work? And how is this next move going to get us to the full goal? That's doing a deal too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So then let's pretend for a second that I have, actually, this is good. This is like a good hypothetical.
Yeah.
So my friend just started a brand marketing agency and she's getting it off the ground. And I was like, oh, that'd be really fun to work with her and have her kind of give us that refresh and just give us like a fresh spin on things. So, okay, that's maybe a good partnership opportunity.
Yeah.
What if I was like, hey, actually, I want to buy your brand marketing agency as it's getting off the ground. You get your clients, like if you're yeah. bringing like an agency model in-house.
Yeah.
How would you approach a micro acquisition of that kind?
Interesting. Okay, so first I would not do an acquisition at all and I would work with that person first because they may be your friend, but
so
you
work
may hate
together
working
first.
With them. Okay. So like just partnership first.
Okay, partnership first.
They have a brand agency is what you're saying?
Yeah, it's brand marketing. I think they're also kind of getting into consulting too.
So does that feel to you like it integrates with your current business or it feels like it's completely separate?
I think there's a potential integration opportunity. Okay. So for the hypothetical's sake, let's say that
yeah.
I'm like, oh, I think that there are tons of people that follow Money with Katie that are starting businesses and would really
yeah.
benefit from having that type of thing to outsource.
Okay,
and
got
I
it.
Want to utilize the fact that I know these people
yeah.
and kind of bring them into the fold and then funnel their business to this person that is now in
love
in,
it.
In the, you know, the holding company, we'll say. We'll
got it. Okay. So as I was saying, I would do a partnership first.
Yep.
Do some sort of referrals, see how the experience is, if you like working with them, if your customers and your audience likes working with them. And then I think it makes sense to have a conversation about full acquisition. And like this space, this acquisition space has really like evolved over the last
okay.
few years.
How so?
There is a website I really like called acquire.com. It used to be called Micro Acquire and they relabeled
They
it
dropped just, the micro.
Which to me is like such a boss.
BDE.
It's what?
BDE.
Yeah, it's definitely BDE. Like, we're not Micro Acquire anymore. We're just the whole Acquire. I love that branding move so much. But it's so funny when I get, like, excited about, like, business
stuff.
You start
just, like, strangling someone that's not there.
It's not a strangle. It's just, like, a... Yeah.
I'm like getting Viking vibes.
It's giving Viking.
Standing
cool.
at the front of the ship.
That's what it is. It's like warrior princess
yes.
energy.
Okay, warrior.
And by the way, that's actually a better description of when I think of the word deals. I think warrior princess more than the Long Island accent in my head. There's warrior princess coming out more so than anything. Okay. So acquire.com is actually really interesting for like, you already know this person that you're mentioning, mm-hmm. but like, if you don't know someone like this, you can go to acquire.com. They have a bunch of listings of businesses that are for sale and you can also sell your business. So it's like a marketplace.
Oh, so I could be like, I want to hire, you know, I want video editing in-house, but I also want to make money off of that too. Like I need that service myself, but I also would like to make money off of it. Could I go on there and be like,
not so much to hire them, to acquire them.
That's what I'm saying. To buy them, to bring them in-house, have
yes.
them do my videos, but also have them doing other videos that it's like becomes a revenue
stream. It becomes
stream.
Part of your business. Exactly. So you would go to acquire.com. You would find a business like that. Usually there's some sort of the way that businesses get valued. This is so interesting too, because like in entrepreneurship, we often talk about like what happens during entrepreneurship, but not the exit and like how to get out of entrepreneurship. And like, usually there's two different ways that companies get acquired and valued.
Okay.
So usually it's either like a cash buyer, someone like kind of thinking about like the financial buyer,
mm-hmm.
thinking about the financials of the business, or a strategic buyer. So like a strategic buyer is thinking about like, I don't really care how much money the business is making. Like, that's not why I'm acquiring it.
Yeah.
You could acquire a business just because it takes you to the future of where you want to go. So like, if you found a business that was doing like cool AI products for financial education, you may not care. You're not like, your goal is not necessarily that you're going to like make a bunch of money from that. It's like, that's going to take you to the future vision, if that were.
Because they already, are you saying that because they already have kind of the knowledge or the skill set or the vision that you're trying
it's
to bring in?
More than it's like aligned to your vision. And usually like big businesses do this, right? So like when Facebook acquires Instagram, I'm pretty sure that the conversation was not necessarily about the financials of Instagram. It was like, this is where we're trying to go from a direction perspective. We have a gap in what we're doing.
So
we
like
don't know how to do this. It's a shortcut.
Okay.
Yeah. So usually strategic acquisitions, this is sort of different than what you'll see on MicroAcquire. Usually strategic acquisitions, it's just kind of like what feels good is the price. Like, you determine the price, not so much on math.
Did you watch Succession?
Of course.
Okay. Given Gojo. Yeah. And the going to Norway to negotiate with Lucas.
What's the scene that you're referring to?
Just when they're like arguing about the price in the gondola, and they're like writing it on the piece of paper, and they're like, I think this is the share price. And then they're just like,
making
I don't even remember the specific
up.
Numbers. But yeah, I mean, that was effectively how it felt. This is the number. So, and then they got that number and they're like, actually, this is the number.
There is a world where it's kind of, this is the number. I think in a more small business space, people are acquiring businesses. You can get acquired. You can acquire businesses. And it's more of like around a multiple. So a multiple is like
explain the multiple.
It's a number that you take, usually either the top line revenue or the bottom line revenue, how much you're bringing in or how much profit. And you multiply it by a number. Usually like service businesses have like a lower multiple, like a 1 or 2x multiple.
Oh,
all the way to software businesses can have like 10x businesses. That's why people like software businesses. They have huge multiples.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. We'll get more into that. And we'll also talk about some of our favorite deals after a quick break.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
So that's essentially what I'm saying. Like, in terms of the learnings from LVMH, from the Kardashians, there's like a couple different ways you can do your own deal in a small business. There's kind of like simple mode, which is like partnerships, which is super doable. Maybe it's intermediate mode because you still got to do the work.
Yeah.
And then there's advanced mode, which is like, I'm going to go acquire business and fold it in. And there's sites like acquire.com where you can do that now.
Okay, I got you. And does acquire, can I ask one more question though?
Yeah.
Does acquire.com, like, does it walk you through the actual financials of the transaction?
Yeah.
I think that's also where I would get stuck.
Yeah, so they have loaded up. Either, like, people can sync their Stripe account, like the business Stripe account is synced so you can see that, or people load up P&Ls. They load up all the financials of the business so you can, like, sometimes they're private, so you, like, sign an NDA is on their platform. You then can see all the information of the business and then have a conversation with the founder. You definitely, like, want to have conversations with them afterwards, but, like, all the financial information is on there, or you load
it up. Okay, so then you can, it's like buying anything else. Like, you can make an offer and say, I'd like to buy your business for this price.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Fair.
So I know you're sort of like joking about deals, but like, you've done some impressive deals, particularly, I know you're working on a book, and I personally am really interested in hearing how you've done that, because I've never written a book and I'm interested in the process.
Yeah.
You have a book deal.
Yes, I do.
Book deal.
Single book deal. It was almost two.
But it's a deal.
But then I said I want to do one. Book deal.
You almost did a double
book
deal?
Book deals.
Wait, so you can sign on to
double deal.
Two books? How does this work?
Yes. Okay, so here's kind of what happened. I first and foremost consider myself like a writer.
Yeah.
And so everything I do is an extension of that in my mind and how I kind of conceptualize
I saw that
this.
On your Instagram. You know how you can put, like, you can categorize yourself?
Yeah.
You have writer.
Yeah,
your
yeah, yeah,
thing,
yeah.
Which I thought was fascinating.
That is just how I got started. That's where I am the happiest.
Yeah.
If I could just write all day, that's what I would want to do.
Okay, got it.
So everything else is kind of secondary to that. But so I always knew I wanted to write one. I wanted to have a book. I wanted to have something in print and not just a digital footprint. Or even when I think about the podcast that I put on, it starts as a very in-depth written script. So what happened was I had been getting some outreach from agents and publishers for a few months, because I think what people don't understand is that as soon as you have a blog that has even a little bit of success and you have some writing out there and you have a little bit of an audience, they're always kind of looking for people that can write that already have a built-in audience. Because
do you think they found you from your blog or from social?
I know how they found me, because the agent that I ended up working with
told me.
And I know how the publisher found me too. The agent had subscribed to someone else's newsletter who would plug my work. And so she started reading my work and was like, this is good. Like, she should write a book.
Did they plug it because you had a partnership, or they just
organic. Yeah. Like, I liked this piece.
Yeah.
So I think that was how the agent found me. I think the publisher, the editor, found me on Instagram, but then went and listened to the show and read the blog and was like, So they both independently, not knowing one another, came to me. And there was a couple other public, like,
do they know each other?
No.
Okay, so
they do now.
Just so I understand all the players in the deal.
There are a couple. So there's
publishers.
There's really two. There's your literary agent who represents you and negotiates kind of on your behalf.
Yes.
And then there's the publisher.
And the publisher does what?
The publisher is the one that prints the book, distributes it, markets it.
So
there's a benefit to working with a big publisher as opposed to pros and cons, right?
Yeah. Because
self-publishing, you keep everything, but you're also fronting all the capital.
Yep.
You are fully responsible for making all the relationships, getting it in bookstores. Whereas if you work with a bigger publisher, they have the relationships, they have the marketing department, but they're taking, obviously, like, they are giving you, in most cases, an advance to write the book.
Yeah.
But you have to then earn out that advance. So they might say, we're going to give you $300,000.
Yeah.
That means you have to, in order to earn any money beyond that $300,000, the book has to sell 120,000 copies. And then you start to make a couple bucks on every copy after that.
After that. Okay.
So I would say that for most people, unless it's a breakout success and you're selling millions of copies, a book, in my mind, is not something you write to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's something that you write for either a reason that is personal to you. Like, in my case, I really wanted to write one.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I actually think it could make a lot of money. So I think it's worth the time.
I kind of heard
and
that
justifiable.
Most scenarios, people just kind of make the advance. Like, you don't get beyond
what that is typical.
You got from the advance.
Yes, especially if the advance is high. So I think that there's...
What's a high advance? Like, what's a one and a high one?
I think that, well, that's a good question. I would say anything in the six-figure range would be big.
Yeah.
I think, like, Prince Harry got, like, 10 million.
Right.
So, like, that's to give that sense of scale, right? And I think, like, mid-six figures is probably, like...
Personal brand. Because, like, Harry's past person, he's, like, into celebrity now.
Right, exactly. Celebrities are going to make millions.
Yeah.
I think that there are some big influencers that could probably get a couple million.
Yeah.
I did not get a couple million, we'll say that. But I think that there are also plenty of book deals that happen with, like, a $10,000 to $50,000 advance. So it's not like it's nothing, obviously. But it's not like, oh, this is going to be my ticket to financial freedom and retirement.
I'm retired now. Yeah,
right?
It's not retirement.
That's not really, in my mind, how the mindset you go in with. But
I think so many people don't know that, by the way. That, like, the strategy around the book deal. And I think the strategy around how you've gone into this is useful because it frames up how you went about structuring it. But the strategy was not necessarily, this is my moneymaker. It was like, this is my...
I think it's a long-term play. I think it gives me some credibility that I can have a book in Barnes & Noble, right? And that I can go on talk
is
shows.
Is Barnes & Noble still open?
Yeah, Barnes & Noble's still open. Hell yeah. Oh my God.
Like physical stores?
Physical stores. Oh yeah.
I thought they went out of business.
Maybe no.
Borders,
maybe. I don't know. Barnes & Noble's very much still open, though.
Wow.
So having a book on a bookshelf in public, like, and then being able to
in
go
the airport and stuff,
being able to be like, I'm the author of this. Like, the second you put that, so I think it's, to me, more about legitimizing.
Particularly as a writer. Right.
Particularly as a writer. So am I happy that I'm going to make money off of it? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the money is actually, like, the highest ROI. I think it's going to serve me a lot in the future as establishing me as a more legitimate
player. Because you establish yourself, you'll make money like
in other ways. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So I think the other thing to note is that, yes, there were agents, but I basically didn't take it seriously until a publisher from one of like the big five publishing houses was interested. Because that's when I was like, they have deep pockets. They have big marketing departments. They are going to help put it on the map in a way that I'm not confident I could on my own, or that I just want to give it the best shot at success. And the way that you sell the book is actually a lot less about having a title and a really strong concept. And it's like the book proposal that you use to secure the deal is far more a marketing document. So it's, here's why people are going to buy this book. Here's who I have access to. Here's why this book is different.
Did you write a proposal first?
Yeah, it was like 70 pages.
So
I wrote several sampled chapters.
Yes.
And you have to annotate the this is what I where I want to take it. Annotated outline kind of, but then sample chapters so they can see that you know how to write.
Yeah.
There's also a piece of this document that, and this is why you work with an agent, because they can really help you with this. I didn't know any of this. The agent told me all of this. She's like, no, you need like, there's a lot here. You also have a section where you talk about who you know. So it's like, I have this journalist connection at New York Magazine. I have, you know, these seven podcasters that all get this many downloads. They have all already agreed to have me on to talk about it. Podcasts are a great way to sell a book. You talk about...
This is slightly the annoying thing to me about the publishing business, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you have to say, here's all the ways that, like, I'm going to be the heavy hitter marketer so that they can do... the marketing,
right? But that's
really a lot of you have to
100%.
Yeah,
but you have to make it. It has to feel and seem and be mutually beneficial, right?
Like
they have
to
see
yeah.
why they're going to give you several hundred thousand dollars, and put all the energy into producing this book for you, and editing it and going through this very laborious process. Because and if you don't like writing, absolutely don't do this. Like it is so much. And like all the citations and the references and
so,
like
I know you did I think you did a deal around this too in terms of like as you were thinking about the people who could help promote it, did you have to like go talk to those people and like
absolutely
negotiate? Like will you promote it before I put this in the proposal?
I reached out to a lot of the people that I know in this space.
Yeah.
So I reached out to people like Chelsea Fagan, who owns The Financial Diet and has published several books. I reached out to the guys that run Choose FI and Mad Scientist and all these people that run other big personal finance brands and said, hey, would you be willing, and like blurbing the book, that's another thing where you like, you know, you turn a book over and there's like people have written reviews on the back cover.
And
this is great because X, like you need to tell the publisher, I already know this person that has 100,000 subscribers and they've already agreed to blurb the book and put their name on the back cover. And so there's a lot of this kind of like hobnobbing and you know asking for favors and then trying
to
get on podcasts.
They just have to say like yes when it comes out I'll do it, but they're not like committing to a thing.
Yeah, no, it's not like they're signing anything. It's just you just have to basically be able to be to the publisher. Like I talked to them and they like verbally told me they will.
We'll do the partnership when it's time.
Yes,
eventually.
It's about like demonstrating that you have those connections and that you have people that will go to bat for you. And so I think that that's where the relationships piece comes in really handy and where the network becomes really important. At least in, from the standpoint of getting the publisher to get excited enough to be like, okay, sure, I'll cut you a check for this and we'll you know, do this project with you. I think
So when you get to the – you have the proposal done, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you give it and you, like, to multiple publishers?
So we gave an exclusive to Penguin Random House because that was the publisher
you
that we –
went straight into one. We know
we said, we're giving you the exclusive. And the reason that you do that, at least in our case, was because – we wanted them to make an aggressive offer. We wanted them to see, okay, we need to give them a high number now so that they don't go shop this around to other places. But you
can put
it up at auction.
The warrior vibe is coming back out, like aggressive offer,
but,
exclusive offer. Okay.
So you want, and it's also to demonstrate, I think, that you are excited to work with them too. And that was the publisher I wanted. I wanted to work with them. I wanted to convey that sense of like, you're my pick. Like,
because they're like a heavy hitter.
Yes. Yeah. They might be the biggest. I don't know for sure, but so we're working with an imprint. There are different imprints within these I
don't know what an imprint is.
It's basically all these smaller brands within Penguin Random House.
Oh,
so
got it.
Our our imprint is called them? Portfolio. Yes.
Deals.
I'm like doing the little money sign. So yeah, so we're working with like the nonfiction, like business and money imprint of Penguin Random House. But I wanted their kind of cachet, and I wanted that like that stamp of approval, kind of.
Yep.
So
okay. I love it.
That's kind of how that works. We gave them the exclusive, but you could put it up for auction and say, "Here is a book. Who wants to buy it?"
Make an offer.
Make an offer. But the risk is that if there's not a bunch of hype and kind of clamoring around this, you might get, like, it only really works in your favor at auction if people are bidding on top of each other and, like, driving up the price.
So that makes sense to me. I was kind of thinking if you do an exclusive offer that they are like, well, they're not even, like, looking at anybody else, so we can give the lowball offer that we want to.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily work that way.
No,
I feel like they give because you give them the exclusive, they come back with a stronger offer.
And because we had been the editor and I at the publisher had been working together over a few months where we had kind of developed the idea a little bit together. And so I think there was a bit of a vested interest and a feeling of like, we're in this together and we want what's best for, like, I think that there was a very much a sense of like, it's in my best interest to work with you. It's in your best interest to work with me. How can we make this as great as possible for one another?
This is really interesting from like a personality types perspective. We did that conversation where we talked about like confidence styles and the like Taylor Swift confidence style that you got. This is like a previous episode we did. The Taylor Swift confidence style that you got was like fosters collaboration and like working together.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about myself in your position, and I think I would have had a hard time just going straight in with exclusive. Like, I want to see,
you know what it is though,
got. But I think your approach is smarter here. I just think like I would be
well not necessarily we don't have a counterfactual in which we know what would have happened if it went to auction.
Right.
But here's why I was okay with it. I in my head had like a minimum where I was like, this is how much I want to make on this book, especially in light of everything else we have going on. Because it's not like I'm taking a year off to write it. It's like, when am I going to write it in tandem with all the other things that we're doing? So I knew that just for it to make sense for the business, it would be irresponsible for me to take on a project like that unless I felt like it was really going to drive things forward for me personally and for the business. So I had a minimum in my head of like, I want to make at least this much. It has to be bringing this much to the table to justify the time that I'm going to spend on it.
So if they come in with their offer there, you're like, okay, great.
They came in above it, and then we negotiated it higher.
Whoop.
So like, I was comfortable. I think at some point there has to be a moment of like, what is enough?
Yeah.
And no, I think I had identified enough.
Particularly since it's not a money strategy for you. It's a distribution strategy and like I'm a writer with this partner strategy.
Yes.
And so if you got the partner that you want, you did the thing.
And I knew that even though if those things were true, if they lowballed me, that would sour how I felt about them and they would no longer be the partner that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't lowball me. So it was like, all right, we see each other. Like, yes, like I see working with you is valuable. You clearly see. They came back and said, can we sign you for two? Will you promise to do two?
Oh.
And we'll give you, you know, 1.75 times as much. But then that was a moment where I was like, I actually feel like in the past I would have taken that because it's like bird in the hand, right? Like,
because they want to lock you in.
They want to lock you in. They say we think you have long-term potential. We think the first book's going to be great. We want to make sure that we get the second one. But I was
tricky,
like,
though, because if the first book does really well, you can come back
and say I want twice as much
with
different
deal.
And I think that in the past, based on like deals I've done in the past, like to get acquired, I always took the safer route. I didn't bet on myself. I bet on let me take the more stable option.
Katie?
I think in this case I was like, I think it's like learning, like, okay, I think I know what I'm capable of. I think I know how much work I'm going to bring to the table and what I'm going to, I think I can make that happen for myself. So let me bet on me this time.
Yeah.
And only do one.
I get that.
And then say, I think this is going to blow it out of the water. And I want the opportunity in the future to be able to go back and have the leverage of like, I didn't already sell the second one. Like,
would you say that the book deal is one of your favorite deals that you've done?
Yes.
Of all time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your favorite?
Okay. I've got two.
Okay.
You tell me which one you want to hear about.
Okay.
I think the income property that I have in Chicago when I bought that and how I strategically bought that. I feel like that was like one deal I'm really proud of. I also have acquired some businesses and some online businesses, apps and tech businesses that also I'm like that deal that I did.
Okay, this is hard. I actually,
those are my top two.
I think I'd want to hear about the income property, actually, yeah, because I think that right now real estate is something that so many, it feels so unattainable.
Yeah.
And okay. I would love to hear how you finagled that.
I have, there's this program called NACA.
NACA. NACA. What is the, say the letters.
N-A-C-A. I'm not NACA. Sure exactly what it stands for. Acronym is. It's like maybe North America. I don't know. But essentially NACA is a nonprofit. They essentially went to the banks after like the 2008 like shenanigans that happened and were like, hey, you guys did wrong.
You've effed up.
You need to be part of some programs to like make this right for the nation.
Yeah.
And so what they do, this program is you can buy a house in partnership with them. It's no down payment, no closing costs, no PMI, which is like the private mortgage insurance extra amount that they charge you if you have a low down payment.
Yes.
So that's gone. They educate you through the whole process because it was my first time buying something. And so you do, there are a lot of classes you have to take throughout, but I was like, I'll take the class because I don't know.
Did it start as an income property or did it start as a place you lived?
No. So the whole strategy. So when I went into this, my whole strategy was I'm going to do what they call like house hacking. I'm going to live in one and I'm going to get like a three or four unit, live in one, rent out the other. So like that was my whole plan. So I was looking at, I went through the program and essentially what they do, or at least at the time what they did was they, you get approved for, usually when you buy a house, you get approved for like the total value of the house.
Yes.
This program approves you for a, what the payment will be.
Oh.
But the reason it's interesting to play this strategy here is like with an income property, they're looking at the amount you pay. So if the other units are paying an amount, if the mortgage is like $3,000 and the other units are bringing in
$2,000. So it's factoring in rental income?
It factors in rental income. So your payment is only $1,000 of that, for example, in that math. So that means that like you can get more of a house in that structure.
And this is specific to like properties that are duplexes, triplexes.
No,
that are like,
so mainly people use it to buy a single family home. I think the interesting way to play it though, is to do the multifamily because actually it increases your budget for the property that you can do. Because if like, you know what I'm saying? Like the monthly payment, you have more that you can fit into the monthly payment.
So interesting that it factors in rental income. That's, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, they do factor in because they really are trying to get people in like good positions. Like they're really conscious about this as a nonprofit. So they factor in 70% of the rental income. So I had like my spreadsheet of like doing the math just in case, right? Like it's an income property. Like it, people might not pay that rent, they'd be late on rent
right,
one month.
Exactly.
Like, so that's why they do 70% to like keep you safe. So
okay.
Essentially when I bought this property, I came out of pocket. I paid $3,000 for
my
earnest money. The property, I bought it for $660K. Right.
And you paid $3,000 out of pocket?
I paid $3,000 for my earnest pay, like earnest deposit, like I'm serious. And I got most of that back at closing. I also had to pay for the inspection separately, but that was like $100, $150, something like that, if I recall. So I got most of the money back from my earnest deposit afterwards. There's also a really interesting structure in it where you can negotiate down the interest rate of the property.
What year was this?
So this program still exists. They're
still exists.
Yes. So they take the current interest rate of like, so whatever the current interest rate
federal funds rate.
The federal funds rate, right? And I actually think theirs is a tiny bit, usually a tiny bit lower than that. They've sort of like negotiated something.
But then you negotiate
it
lower?
But then you can negotiate it down. So the way you can negotiate it down is you can buy it down. You can pay in this
points.
Program. So you can either, you can pay it down, but the way to strategize this is I didn't come out of pocket to negotiate mine down. So the way you play this is why it's like one of my favorite deals I've done.
Okay.
Is I went to the seller and I said, you're selling it for, I don't know, like maybe 700K.
Yeah.
I don't want to pay 700K. I want to pay 660. Don't give me the, don't reduce the price. I'll pay you whatever the amount is, but just give me credits, essentially. Does that make sense? So you can give, so people can give you credit at closing instead of lowering the price. It's the same to the seller. Right, the seller pays the same amount.
But I would think, I guess where I'm thrown then is how that works with the seller is the one determining the price, but they're not providing the financing for it. So why would they care what the interest rate you're paying? Because they're getting
No. They don't care at all what interest rate you're paying. And to them, it's literally the same. So
either they
come down in price or they give you the credits at the closing. To them, it's the same. But for me, it's not the same. For me, I can use those credits to buy down in NACA's program. I can use those credits to buy down the interest rate.
Interesting. Okay.
Otherwise, if I wanted to do it otherwise, I would have to come out of pocket to buy down the interest rate. So I bought down the interest rate and took advantage of that just by negotiating it well and asking for one, give it instead of doing the price down, just give it to me in this way. Same thing for you, but really benefits me.
I guess, how is it the same thing for them though? If they're giving you credits at closing, does that mean that they're covering your closing costs?
No. So the credits at closing, so if let's say that the property
was, who's giving you the credits?
The seller is giving the credit. So the credits are like, I'm going to come down in price, essentially. So we agree their price was a little bit too high. We are going to come down in price. So they agree to that. And there's two ways that they can do that. They can do the credits at closing, and that's them coming down at price at closing, or they can just reduce the price of the actual property itself.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. I guess I don't
Because usually when you buy a property, there's some negotiation. Maybe the listing price is not exactly what
I guess
you
I'm not familiar with to. The credits. Is the credits
I wasn't either. So,
specific to NACA? I don't think that's like a...
So I think it might be. It might be. I'm not actually sure. What I do know, buying down the interest rate in that way is specific to NACA. Right.
Okay.
That's specific to that program. So essentially, it was like me looking at the terms of this program and like, how do I make good use of it?
And how did you apply to be in it? Is it just an application?
Yeah, like you go to a class and there's two different tiers that you can be in, essentially, like there's a high income bracket and a low income bracket. And if you're in a higher income bracket, you're limited to like geographies. Like if you look at a map, there's like certain areas of a city, but like it's pretty expansive. I didn't feel limited by it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So was any part of this like tax strategy or tax planning?
No, this was pre me being that savvy about tax planning. So I did this in maybe like 5 years ago, and I wasn't really like as like now I like really like tax strategy.
Yeah,
for example, when I acquired the couple businesses that I've bought, I did that primarily as a tax strategy.
How and why?
Okay, so in business, we often talk about like the goal is to like make a lot of money and have a bunch of profit.
Yeah.
But then once you have a bunch of profit, you're like, oh, shoot, the government.
Now I have to pay a bunch of taxes on the profit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so if let's say that you were going to like take some of that profit at the end of the year and like some of it goes to you, but like some of it you want to like reinvest back into other things. If you pay taxes on it first, you have less to reinvest back into some things. This is like the whole concept of like having like more business expenses where people talk about you should business expense that, right? Because then it goes out, you
lowers your like taxable
income. Lowers the amount that you're taxed on, right? Yeah. So what I did was before we got taxed at the end of the year, I went to Acquire, was then Micro Acquire, and I found some businesses that had products that my community at Apps Without Code needed. So like I have this community of folks who are building businesses, building tech-enabled businesses, but they also need websites. They also need copywriting. They also need all these other things. So I found businesses that my community needed. And I also probably, most of those, I was referring people to other softwares to use for it. And so I just acquired my own.
Okay, so you're basically bringing the services in-house. That way you're controlling the entire end-to-end process.
Exactly, yeah. First, I tried to operate them separately. It was a lot of extra work for them to be like totally separate businesses with totally separate leadership. So like it's more family now.
Okay.
But yeah, so exactly. So I was thinking about what are the other things people need, but that was largely tax strategy and the way that I had to structure it for it to be tax strategy. Because typically if you buy a business, we're getting kind of like technical now.
Yeah, but this is good. I want you to get technical.
If you buy a business, there's still like capital gains, like higher taxes on that.
Yeah.
And so what we did was we agreed to a price that I was going to buy the business for.
Okay.
But what we did was on the actual deal, let's say that I'm going to acquire the business for like 50K. So what we did for the actual deal is for the assets themselves that I'm buying, that's 5K. So we have two separate contracts.
Okay.
they get signed all together, but like just one stack of papers.
So it's no different to the person that's...
It's no different to them, but it's different to me.
Right. So $5K for the assets and then what, $45K in payroll?
$45K for an independent contractor fee for them to do the transition of the business, because part of what we agreed with was that they would stay for a couple months to just help aid the transition, right? So it's not a...
Interesting. So I guess I would have thought that the capital gains... would be something that the seller would be paying, because they're realizing the gain on like the asset.
Yeah, I think if you're buying an asset, you're also it's just that you can't. It's not an expense anymore, is really what it is, right? So, hiring a contractor, that's a regular business expense.
Did you work with an accountant to do this?
Ooh, okay, great. So first of all, my mom is an accountant.
Keep it in the family.
However, accountants tend to be like conservative on like, but what could we do that's still legal, right?
You know what I was like, just thinking.
So this was not necessarily my mom's strategy. What were you thinking?
There's a joke about how you you want a Republican accountant but a liberal barista.
Yeah, like, pretty much.
You want your accountant to be like tax avoidant, but okay. So you're saying that the
say that again. You want a
Republican accountant, but you want a liberal barista. It's like this joke about it was like a TikTok thing. Okay,
yeah.
So you're saying that you didn't. So did you work with an accountant, or were you like trying to figure something out?
Around this time, what I learned is like the ideal structure, right? Is that you have like. I'm going to say financial advisor, but I don't mean the traditional, like you have a financial strategist. You have a strategist that manages the accountant, the lawyer, those people.
And
I worked with, his name is Justin. He's really incredible. His company is called Unorthodox, actually. And so he helped me. He's really good at being like, your job is to go like find the thing. My job is to like make it work from a strategy perspective so that it's most advantageous. And he's really good at being able to speak languages of the CPAs, the accountants.
Right.
So like when he translates it to the lawyers, to the CPAs, they're like, oh yeah, like I know what that
is.
I probably would have said it in a way that sounded way like riskier and crazy. And they would have been like, no, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But, like, he's good at like, here's how we can make something work. We're just going to hire them as a contractor to do the transition. And we're also going to buy their assets. And we've identified the price for each.
Okay. So you looked at this thing that you said, okay, I've too much profit this year, we'll say, and I need to find a way.
Which is really ridiculous. Like it sounds,
yeah, but
ridiculous.
Like leverage it productively,
yeah.
Right? Like
so I
want to
get my butt kicked on taxes.
I would like to spend it on something that's going to be advantageous for the future.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I think in my mind, I'm like, well, I'm going to take the profit and invest it in public markets. I'm going to pay the taxes on it, or I'm going to invest it in a pre-tax account.
Yeah.
And I'm going to invest it in public markets where I'm going to make. So it's a different approach.
It's a totally different approach.
Mine is definitely more risk averse.
I think for me, I have more faith in myself at this point. And this is because I'm young. I'm in my 30s. Like my strategy is like I can take a business and triple it. And I don't feel like in a short period of time, and I don't feel like my investment in a public market is going to be able to do that. I have a high faith in myself, particularly when I'm playing in my lane, right? Like, I'm not going and buying something that's, like, completely I have no idea about.
You know,
like,
You understand what you're buying.
Yeah, I understand the space. I have people asking me for recommendations for that thing. Like, I feel pretty confident about that.
Okay.
And so for me, like, speaking of it, kind of circling it back to Monopoly.
Well, because you're, like, tripling. You're like, I want to triple it. I'm like, I don't care to triple it. I just want an average. I want 8% per year.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
By the way, like my strategy will change at some point. Like I don't think I'm going to be 70 saying like, I'm going to like take the business and the goals to triple it. I'm gonna be like, no, just give me my 8%. So I think like my strategy is definitely going to change. I think right now I've got energy. I'm smart. I've got like access to things and more than anything, I love this stuff. Like I'm having
fun. Gotta make hay while the sun shines.
It's my joy to kind of like figure out how to play the game of life and to like play this part of the game of life. And
it energizes you.
It energizes me. Yeah. And I realize it feels like play and fun for me. So like that's kind of more of where I spend my time now, but that's going to change.
We need to do an episode about financial positions and our financial strategies personally, like as people. Yeah, I think that would be really, really cool because I'm just dying to know more about how you've. I'm like, I want to see the books.
Yeah.
I want to get in there and I want to see
books like what I'm reading.
Your personal like
my business books.
What I'm reading.
It's like my books, like my book
no,
shelf?
Like your yeah, yeah, like your personal,
let's talk about
how
it.
Much you pay yourself, and like you know where you're putting money for the future, and yeah. how much of this is you reinvesting, and basically, there's almost I think about it in two different ways.
Yeah.
It's either kind of the tech company model mm-hmm. where it's like high growth. I'm yeah. not paying dividend. I'm focused on as plowing as much as I can
yeah.
into getting this thing as big as it yeah. can be. Or it's okay, things are working well. I'm going to kind of get to a point where I can kind of sustain this and yeah. just the slow and steady approach.
Yeah.
And I think we represent two different sides
yeah,
big time.
I think that's right.
So I'm like, I want to get an understanding of like how you see this playing out long term.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to have to work on that one.
Okay, I'm good with this. I'm excited for that conversation.
I know, me too. Well, I think this is a great place to wrap.
Yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Bossy. We will see you next week, same time, same place, right here in this beautiful pink set.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.